children would have introduced the So, just to give a quick background, the development policy of research units is focused on the school of economics. We focus on labour markets, poverty and inequality, which are three big areas. And then we do a lot of research on those areas, but then anything really that touches on those areas. So we do some work in terms of education, some work in terms of health, some work in terms of demography and so on. Yes?
Could you please raise the volume of
audio? Okay. I don't know how to do that. Okay, then we'll move back then. Right, is that better? No, not better. Okay. Is that better?
Yes.
Okay, cool. Right, so like I was saying, we do a lot of work on the labor market, poverty and inequality. Those of you who were here on Tuesday, I think was in the world, was that we are sort of a sister unit to the university group associated with. We've been going for about 20 years or so. And really, we do quite a lot of work with the government in terms of informing policy. And so that's one of the things that I really enjoy about working there is that we have this interaction with government and we have to try and inform the policy that you make. Not always successfully, but we do make it. My specific area, so I work generally in labor, but I've done a lot of work. The page that you will have received, hopefully, is one of the outputs that we produce, which is just really a fact sheet. You've only got two pages, so I don't want to finish the whole thing, but I just want to give you something concrete with some numbers on it, because I won't be showing you lots of tables, I will be showing you lots of pictures and graphs. So I just want to give that to you so that you have something for those of you that want to see what the exact statistics are. That's the most recent stats that you have. Okay. So, just in terms of what I'm going to be talking about, I'm going to give you a quick run through some of the definitions that I will be using. I don't generally like to punch people into definitions. But it's really important that we just cover that ground so some of you might know the stuff and other people might not. And then we'll look at some of the labor market trends in the first 5 year period, and I'll explain in the first 5 year. I'll talk about some of the labour market trends in the first 5 year period, and I'll explain the reason why we're going to really look at this period. Then what I'll talk about is the impact of the global economic crisis. So the South African case in terms of the economic crisis is quite unique, and we are one of the countries in the world that has had the largest employment, the largest labour market impact from the economic crisis. And then I'll talk about some of the key labour market challenges, and this is really trying to look at some of the characteristics of the labour market that you're trying to grapple with, or the government is trying to grapple with, and that the research community is trying to understand better.
Okay, so in terms of definitions, if you imagine this block to be the population of the country, of any country really, and those are the ages I've just put at the top,
so 0 between 65 and 90. Or 90 plus is really just a catch-all at this point. But the two important ages for us in terms of labour markets are 15 to 65. And this age group, 15 to 65, we refer to as the working age population. But these are the people who are legally allowed to work, and it's essentially because people are until they're able to retire. So it's really the group within the population who in 3 states the productivity and working.
Now, within that group, we have a group of people who are employed.
Now, these people, in South Africa, we use the ILO definition, which is quite a loose definition of employment. So it really is trying to include any kind of productive economic activity, but it should be remunerated. So it's not, we're not talking about, for example, a safe environment for it in the home, because we can't, that version of the remunerated is living in this environment. But really, anything else that is remunerated or that is sort of for profit will be included in the product, and it can be for very short periods of time, which you might. So the questionnaire, for example, asks people have been living even 1 hour. So it's really quite a broad definition. We then have a group of people who are unemployed. Now these people are looking for work. They're willing and able to work, and they really check if work should the work arrive. And these are people, unemployed people, and more technically called strictly unemployed, or called narrow unemployed. We then have a group of people, which is a really important group of people, which we call discouraged work seekers. So these people are people who would like to work. And they are willing and able to work, they are ready to start working, to work right, but they are not actively searching for work. So they're not doing anything to find work, they're not applying for jobs, they're not talking to people to find out what options are available. So they're really sort of, they're not active in terms of their search, and so we call it the non-searching unemployed or discouraged work seekers. Now that group, the employed and the unemployed, we call the labor force. Some people get confused between the labor force and the workforce. Now, the workforce is really employed people. So the workforce is the employed, but the labor force is employed plus unemployed people. And when we work out the unemployment rate, we work out what is the proportion of the unemployed within the labor force. Okay. If we include discouraged work seekers, then we say these people are also unemployed, which in South Africa, we call that labor force rule and labor force, because our definition is quite a broad definition of employment. So really, and there again, if we work out the unemployment rate, the broad unemployment rate is unemployed plus discouraged rate as a proportion of the labor force. Okay. And then one other important thing to note, we also talk about an employment to population ratio, which is a way of trying to measure the dependency on workers. So how many people are reliant, it's sort of an indirect measure of how many people are reliant on workers. So we kind of see, obviously, the more employed people we have within the working age population, the better it is for us, because we've got more productive people, more incomes coming into households. And so, obviously, we would want that to be higher.
And I'll show you later that South Africa's is quite interesting. Okay, so in terms of labour market trends in the post-apartheid period, as the project ends, there was significant change, political change, economic change, and social change. We had essentially, in the period leading up to the end of the project, we had an erosion of income tax controls and job reservation and those type of laws that were in place. We had a lot of, well, there was an abolition of the restrictions and controls of them, so the types of jobs that people could apply for, their geographic mobility, all these kinds of things were eradicated. We were also in a period during which there was a lot of economic liberalisation. It really accelerated post-94, but it was a period where the rest of the world was liberalising. And really the start of this big period of globalisation. And really that's one of the key challenges that South Africa is facing to the labour market. Gone from a very protected environment into this very competitive global environment. We also have, in 1994, especially, a greater recognition of workers' rights. So we had a variety of legislation that was passed, the Labour Relations Act, the Occupational Health and Safety Act, and the Basic Functions and Employment Act. And these were all pieces of legislation that were aimed to benefit workers, protect workers, and to ensure that their rights were compromised. At the same time, we had rapid technological change. So we went from sort of very manual kind of manufacturing, for example, into an era of highly mechanized computerized manufacturing. And this is something that's affected pretty much every sector. So you see it in agriculture, in terms of mechanization. You see it in the service sector with computers, especially. And so we see in terms of productivity, we're able to achieve a lot more with the same. And then we have this rise of low-cost producers in Asia, especially China, but also in these other countries, which have served as really strong competitors for particular sections of our particular manufacturing sector. Okay. Obviously, with the rise of China, it's not all bad, because China is a huge market for us in terms of our raw materials. So that's one of the things that has sustained us, particularly in the 2000s. So quickly, in terms of the features of the post-1994 labour market, I will show you quickly some broad trends, employment and unemployment trends, and then really look at some of the factors that underlie these trends. So we look at labour force participation. So that's the proportion that the labour force is of the working age population. So how many people? Yes. So the labor force participation rate is really trying to measure what is the likelihood that people are participating in the labor force. And obviously we want that to be quite high so that we have more workers relative to non-workers. I'll look at the employment to population ratio, and then in terms of one of the big changes that we've seen over the last 20 years is really a structural change in terms of the economy that has affected labor. Okay, so this is a graph that's showing employment and unemployment numbers since 1994, well, really since 1995. And the big challenge thing that you have within this field is that you rely on household survey data. There might be mention of that already in previous lectures, but we rely on household surveys, so basically like a census, but much, much longer. So we're talking sometimes 60, 70 questions. And these surveys need to cover the entire population. We need to have a survey that is nationally representative so that we can use those results and draw your conclusions about the whole economy. Now, the big problem is that before 1994, we had parts of present South Africa that weren't counted as part of South Africa. So in 1994, for example, there was a survey, but it didn't include the Transkei and the other homelands. So it wasn't nationally representative. And because it wasn't really a major issue in terms of the political radar, there wasn't a lot of effort put into surveys and stuff like that. So the 1990s was really the period of introduction of the surveys and sort of learning how to use surveys. So in 1995, we had our first nationally representative survey. And over the 1990s, with help from the ILO, the International Labour Organization, Statistics South Africa started refining the surveys, and they started making changes in 1980. So one of the problems, for example, in 1995 is that we don't have how big the informal sector was, because they didn't ask the questions properly. So we had the OHS's, the October Household Survey, from during the 90s. We then had a new survey introduced in 2000, which is the labor force survey. And that survey was already a much better survey, and it had statistics that were much less over the period. So we consider most of the period of the LMS was the labor force survey to be a period where you can actually compare the data and make some conclusions. Recently, some of you might know that statistics introduced a new labor force survey, a quarterly labor force survey. So this is now once a quarter, and it's actually a very different survey to the LMS. The labor force survey, for example, was 1 week. They sent the people out to the field for 1 week. They got the answers to the survey and they came back to the office. Whereas the pre-LMS is run on a continual basis. So every given day, there are some people being surveyed for quarterly labor force survey. So it's much more. It's trying to capture the whole quarter as opposed to 1 week. Now, the big problem with this is that it's become really difficult to compare over time. And so, for example, you won't find many people that are doing comparisons between 2011 and 1995, just because we know that there's such big problems in the data. The one thing that you can see, though, from this graph is that over the period, over the 90s, we saw an increase in employment.
unemployment, so employment was increasing. We saw an increase in unemployment numbers, and this is when we started becoming worried about what was going on in the labor market, because we were looking at massive increases in unemployment. And this was at the time where we were really opening up the market, opening up some trade and so on. But the big problem is that these surveys, because they've been gradually refined, it's very difficult to say for certain that these changes that we see are actual changes, or whether they were just something that was wrong in the survey, or we changed the question and asked it differently this time and it's changed the results. So some people do use this. We use it in our unit, but I prefer not to use the 1990 survey data because we just don't know how much it is real. The 2000s, though, we see employment is quite flat for a long time, and then really in 2004 we saw this surge in employment. That it really it was the first time that we saw unemployment numbers fall, the actual numbers start falling. So we had seen unemployment rates falling, and I'll show you that just now, but this was the first time that we saw unemployment numbers falling. Of course, we couldn't track it for very long because a new survey then came in. And you can see what the impact of that new survey was in terms of unemployment. Suddenly, our unemployed people, a huge proportion of them, maybe about 1.5 to 2 million unemployed people disappeared. Okay? And how they disappeared is we said, actually, these people are not looking for work, they're not really able to work. We do not consider them to be economically active, and so the definition may be that they're to be economically active. So out of the labor force and into the work, just to be economically active population. If we add on pure labor, another one thing that's really nice about pure labor is it gives us much more regular data, and so we see quite clearly the progress of the recession. It's quite small there, but you'll see unemployment falls quite quickly, and it basically does nothing, it hasn't done anything since about 2009, while unemployment has been increasing and increasing over the period of time. This is the unemployment rate, again you can see how the different surveys that we have our time series, so that's why I don't link them up. But you can see generally a similar pattern. Now this is the broad and narrow definition. Broad unemployment rate is much higher, so it reaches up into the lower 40s. The peak was 51.8% in 2002, but this is declining. You can see it in surveys make a huge difference in the way that we measure unemployment. What you will see that is that the narrow unemployment rate started falling quite rapidly, especially since the early 2000s. It fell quite rapidly. There were some definitional changes, but it was something that was changing quite quickly. And so so it's really an issue of people, those people who were looking for work were finding work, whereas the people who were not looking for work were less likely to find work. And so we see the broader overall rate is much higher than
what
that
is.
It is in some parts in terms of the World Cup having been a boost to the economy. So with construction, and I'll show that just now in terms of sectors, there were sectors that grew very strongly, and one of them was construction, and that's very much it. To the World Cup, also to the housing market that was doing really well at the time.
Okay. Looking in terms, this is now the world labor force participation. So it's the proportion of people in the working population who are participating in the labor market, so who are either employed or unemployed. Now this is a really important proportion or statistic for us because it starts showing the involvement of the working age population in the labor market. In societies, for example, where women's work is frowned upon, you'll see low labor force participation rates because they aren't able to participate in the economy. We really look at labor force participation, the higher it is, the more capable it is for the economy. Now what you can see here is this very big increase in labor force participation during the 1990s. And so one of the arguments really is that this change in society during the mid-1990s released a huge sort of demand But since then, you can see that not much has been going on. So the 2000s is pretty much flat, if you take out some of the bumps. In 2008, if we compare from 2008 onwards, it's again very flat without huge change. And so it again calls into question the 1990s data, whether it's real or is something that was caused by the second. But I think it's something that there's pretty much agreement on, that we did see this big increase in terms of labor participation rates during the 1990s as it goes into the labor market. Okay, so I've discussed that. Okay. Now, in terms of employment to population ratio, like I said earlier, the employment to population ratio is sort of a measure of the extent to which we depend on the number of workers. So if our employment to population ratio is low, it means our population is very reliant on a small number of workers. Okay. So, for example, employment to population, if it was 0.5 or 50%, it would mean for every one worker in employment, we've got two people out of employment. And so we really have this big dependence on a small number of workers. Whereas if it's high, we would have very few people relying on a huge number of workers, which is obviously better. Now, this is a graph that the data I got from the ILO, and it's really, I don't think all the countries say it, but these are all countries of bars. The countries of the world range from the lowest employment population to the highest employment population. So you can see there's quite a big range from around about 40% to almost 90%. Now, if we look at the countries that are similar to South Africa, so we look at upper middle income countries, or South Africa is, those lighter bars are examples of upper middle income countries. So you can see even amongst upper middle income countries, we've got quite a good spread in terms of labor force, in terms of the employment to population ratio. If we want to compare it to other countries that we usually compare ourselves with, we can compare ourselves to the BRIC countries. So Brazil, Russia, India, and China. And we can see even amongst those four countries have a big difference. China is a high employment population, employment to population ratio. Brazil, the lower, Russia, the lower. Okay. If I show you where South Africa is, you'll see we're very different. We are very different to the BRIC countries. We have much fewer workers relative to the population. But even amongst all the BRIC countries, we're one of the lowest employment population ratios. And this is one of the big conundrums of the South African labor market. Why do we have so few people employed, whether it be the formal or the informal sector? So this includes formal and informal sector, a very low proportion of people are actually employed. And this is the one thing this is one of the big questions within the labour market.
What countries are to the left of South Africa?
It's generally war-torn countries where state wants to go out and work. So where essentially where the economy is in the ruins, become very low and also in some of the Eastern countries are very low on the left, some have grown very fast in terms of
And in the same example, Arctic low on the Rockies, low on the Great, high on the Rockies, on the Rockies, high on the Great. The size of the circle, the size of the bubble, is an indication of how big is the sector in terms of total footprint. Because it doesn't help if we get all excited about a tiny little sector gray, really fast, gray, it's incredibly really fast. Where you have a huge sector to read and you run into stream. So this is just a way to put those sectors into perspective. Now what we can do is we can draw this line, and it's basically a 45 degree line, but what it's saying is anything to the left of that line, output is growing faster than the point. So basically, productivity in those sectors is going up because your incline growth is faster than your output. Sorry, your output growth is faster than your incline growth. On the other side of the line, we've got the output is growing slower than that incline. Now the interesting thing to see here is that all sectors, so we're looking at the left points of those circles, all sectors are on the left hand side of that line. So all sectors of the period grew their output faster than they grew. And that's one of the big worries in terms of employment is why are we seeing employment growth lagging out growth faster than that? And one of the reasons is technology and mechanization of production. Now I'm just going to pick out a couple sectors that are important. Agriculture and mining are sitting on their own. Both of them saw contractions in employment. Agriculture saw a small increase in output of the period, but mining saw basically it's a zero over the period. So this is real growth. So those sectors in terms of employment have been lacking the most because they've been shedding jobs. In agriculture it's hundreds of thousands of jobs over the last year. Over the last decade have been lost. Let me look on the right hand side of the graph. Two big sectors that have been well, construction and finance. Finance is a quite a big sector which is kind of finance is easy to name, so it's not banks only. It is financial and business services, it covers estate agents, it covers call centers, it covers the banks, it covers insurance companies, but it also goes all the way down the spectrum to labor workers. So essentially, tech agencies, the labor, and sort of the small scale labor workers are sort of acting as a little bit for construction workers or security workers or whatever it is. So those sectors have done really well. They've grown really rapidly. And they've grown in 2023. In fact, construction has been a couple of spots higher in terms of the size of this employment group in other sectors when you rank them. The one disappointment, though, is manufacturing. You can see it's in just above the line, it's a big green circle. So it's a big sector, its output is not moving very fast, maybe 2%, just over 2% a year, and its employment is growing by a very small proportion, maybe 0.5% per year. So very slow growth of employment. And this is really a sector where a country of our development level would be looking for jobs. And so it's one of the some analysts will point to manufacturing sector's poor performance as one of the reasons why we haven't had a good labor market performance already. Okay, this is just to give you an idea of size of employment within an economy. And you can see those are the proportions. So in 2001, 10.5% of employment was in agriculture, and that fell to 5% 9 years later. So a big drop in terms of their relative share of employment. And similarly, So we have those three sectors that I've spoken about that are doing quite weakly. They've lost share of employment within the economy. And we've seen this real growth in terms of construction, so from 5% to 8.3%, and then in finance. And then CSP services, you'll see it on the handout as well, is community, social, and personal services, which is a fancy word for governance and a little bit around that. It includes, so it's basically government, teacher services. And so that sort of, it's also a lot of NGOs before, and that's actually very important. But we've seen that sector over the period, you can find a strong growth.
What is W and R?
Sorry?
W and R.
W and R, sorry, it's wholesale and retail trade. So basically the retailers, it's retail sector. And then private households is almost exclusively domestic workers, but domestic workers broadly defined. So domestic workers in the household, gardeners, chauffeurs, but those types of jobs are in private households.
Okay, the global economic crisis. What I've done, so this is again from 2002 onwards. I've just put that dark, the darker color at the bottom so you can see where negative territory is in terms of growth. And this is just looking at output growth and employment growth. And so we see over the 2000s this gradual improvement in terms of employment growth. Output growth was fine, but employment growth was not consistently good. But we do see this gradual improvement, and so employment growth started accelerating over the period. If we add on a couple periods, so that's the first 3 quarters of 2008, this was a period during which the extent of the housing crisis in the US and the constant crisis in the rest in Europe and so on was becoming evident. And so we see a slowing down of employment growth. And then after that, if you see a massive drop, we first see a drop in terms of output, so we go into recession in 2009, but we see in employment a much bigger reaction. So we lose a lot of jobs very quickly. It was about 19,000 jobs in 3 quarters. To give you an idea, at that point, employment was around about 14 million people. So 1 million people lost their jobs at that point. So we lost 19,000 within 3 quarters, and then over the next year, we lost 150,000. So we lost around just over 1 million jobs from the peak of employment in 2008. Now, the one important thing is that the labor market reaction is much bigger than the GDP reaction. So we went into recession. It wasn't a huge recession, it was just over -2% in that worst quarter, but employment shrank about 6%, but it's worse, and stayed in negative territory for much longer. And this has been one of the interesting things about the global recession is how come in South Africa is translated into this big labor market reaction, where in other countries the labor market reaction was there, but it wasn't as strong as it was in South Africa.
What was that?
Okay, so I'm going to take it. Cool. Okay, so this is looking at just the 2000, from 2008 onwards, oh, sorry, from 2009 onwards, that might be the longer series. But this is looking at changing employment year on year, so I'm comparing first quarter of 2009 to first quarter of 2008, and I'm trying to break open where are the jobs being lost. So in that first quarter of 2009, you can see in agriculture and in the informal sector, employment growth is negative, so there's a loss of jobs of around about 200,000 jobs. But we can see the formal sector and private households, grew by just over 300,000. So in the first quarter, we still have positive employment growth. What we do see, though, is that the informal sector reaction is very strong, very quick. So even in that first quarter, the informal sector is contracting in terms of employment, which is not how we would expect. We would have thought the formal sector employment would grow first. We do see formal sector employment growing much, well, going into the negative territory by the third quarter of 2009, and there were significant job losses there. But it was the informal sector that grew first. Agriculture has been losing jobs pretty much throughout the period, so it's not really helping us to explain what is going on. What is interesting, though, is that once the formal sector jobs had started being lost, we saw formal sector jobs growing, and at the same time that formal sector jobs were growing, private household jobs were growing as well. So as people were losing their jobs, they were laying off domestic workers, or they were reducing hours and so on. Well, not reducing hours, but definitely a loss of employment.
Why should agriculture jobs
change? Agriculture has been declining. It's in serious decline. We've done a report for the Western Cape
economists and all lawyers to try and understand what parts of the labor law are causing problems in the labor market. And so what you find is that, for example, the hiring and firing costs in South Africa are quite low. So it's not an issue that hiring workers is really expensive or firing is really expensive, but there are provisions in the labor law which make it very difficult. So if the rigidity of the labor market is quite high in terms of a lack of flexibility, and that can be pointed to the existence of provisions within the labor law. And so there is a lot of work. I think Nikki spoke to you about the Negro Farm last time. And one of the things in the Trigger Plan, the NDP Plan, was also to try and reduce sort of some of the rigidities in the labor market. It's obviously very difficult. Also, given where we've come from, we have a very adversarial labor relations environment. So this is not really to be an inch, labor is not really to be an inch. I don't think that business really trusts government to be independent of labor. And so I think there's a lot of stuff going on that makes it very difficult to come to solutions on these kind of issues. But where you see that labor, where employers and unions are willing to negotiate and there's a give and take, you do see the big progress being made in terms of these kind of things. I think it's in the textile industry, for example, where a big union is to take on with young workers below minimum wage, trying to get into the products. And the unions have said, fine, if it's the cost of workers and it's such an important, we'll lower the cost of workers. But if after 2 years employment hasn't changed, then that's not the problem and we'll go back to common work. And I think that's a fair kind of, we need to try and find solutions on these things. I think it's really in a very, it's a sort of a desperate situation. We need to try and experiment and see what kind of policy we can be with.
Okay. In terms of unemployment, we saw quite an interesting thing. So we see that's the broad and the narrow unemployment rates, the broad obviously at the top and the narrow at the bottom, in decline since 2008, and suddenly they take off. But it's really the broad unemployment rate that takes off. So this is where we're including discouraged work seekers. And we see the gap between the broad and the narrow increasing over time. But that gives you an indication of how many discouraged work seekers there are. So about 8%. Of broad unemployment is discouraged work seekers. So it's about 8 percentage points, sorry. So there's about a quarter of unemployed people according to the broad definition are not seeking work. Okay. And we see this big reaction in terms of discouraged work seekers. And this is really sort of the story in the South African labour market at this point, is that people didn't lose their jobs and say, okay, I'll look for another job. They lost their jobs and the situation was made so gloomy in terms of having lost their jobs that they didn't actively seek work, or they realized that there wasn't much room laying around and taking forward. So we see this broadening, this widening of the gap between the two unemployment rates. So just to sort of summarize, we have a financial crisis and soon global recession, which slows growth in South Africa's trade partners. And it's really through our trading with other countries that the financial crisis impacted on our labor market. So as demand from our trading partners declined, the domestic demand for labor declined. So the formal sector was saying, well, look, there's no demand for our products, we need to cut back. And so that's probably one of the reasons why we saw a slow reaction in the formal sector, because firms were holding on to workers, not sure how bad the situation is. And then when they realized that we were in a dire situation, they started getting job orders quite rapidly. Like I said, we lost $900,000 in 9 months, and a further $150,000 in the following year. So just under 2 years, we lost over a quarter of a million jobs. And we see a very sequential impact, first in the informal sector, then the formal sector, accounting about 5%. One of the speculations about why the informal sector lost jobs first is that people saw the crisis coming. So the public says something is going on. Things on the rates in the US, people talking about recession and so on. And so people cut back on discretionary spending, and a lot of discretionary spending is actually in the informal sector. So people stop buying from informal traders
quite a lot of services on providing the information, and so that's why we think the informal sector and the large jobs match well first, and then it's followed by the formal sector. And you see this massive rise in discouragement. I need to be very quick. Unemployment rates. This is just to give you an idea of what unemployment looks like. Total unemployment is around 33.4% at the moment. But we see very big disparities in terms of unemployment. We see that white unemployment rate is about 7% now overall. So this includes discouraged rate seekers. For Africans, it's 40%. We see lower for men than for women, which is pretty much common around the world. And we see a huge dispersion by age. So young people have much higher unemployment rates than older people. And even when we control for education, so even if you say amongst university graduates, unemployment rates for young people are much higher than for older people. Importantly, that red dot there is the average for 15 to 34 year olds. That's the group in South Africa we call youth. And if we disaggregate that by race, we can see very different unemployment rates amongst young people. And so the broader unemployment rate for white young people is around 10%, whereas the unemployment rate for African young people is 10%. So one in two African people between the ages of 15 and 34 are unemployed. So this is one of the most important insights that you can that I can try and tell you tonight. This massive inequality in terms of labour market outcomes in South Africa. And that's just education, which follows a very similar, well, a very expected pattern. High education is low unemployment. Okay, youth unemployment. So I've said youth unemployment is quite serious. 15 to 34 year olds account for 58% of the working age population, but they're only accounting for 42% of the employed people. So they're very much underrepresented in employment. They account for 71% of unemployed people. Okay, so much bigger than their population proportion, and around 70% of discouraged work seekers. 55% are unemployed. 55% are employed. 30% are unemployed. According to the narrow definition, so this is simply worth 30%. 50% are discouraged. 28% of unemployed young people have never worked before. 28% of young people have never worked before, and 91% of unemployed young people who are not searching for jobs are not searching for jobs because they are no jobs. So it's not that they're sitting back and saying, oh, the jobs come to me, they just are no jobs in their areas. One of the explanations for the poor performance is our weak informal sector. The informal sector is very weak. This graph just shows you the share of total non-agricultural employment that the informal sector accounts for. South Africa is the fifth from the top at around 32%. You see other countries much higher, India is 83%. So huge informal sectors relative to the informal sector. Now that comes with its own challenges because the informal sector is unregulated, it's unprotected, wages are low, conditions are poor, but it's something that and the reason why is because the informal sector acts as a sponge for unemployed people. So in other countries where we have higher unemployment by some measure, their informal sector absorbs the unemployed people. Whereas in South Africa, the informal sector just doesn't. And so we see this mass of unemployed people. And the reason for this is being quite a lot of work is about barriers to entry, constraints on activity, a lack of links between informal and so some countries are very strong in businesses in formal and businesses in
yeah. Could you spell out a little more detail?
Okay, so barriers to entry really are things that stop people from entering the informal sector.
Such as?
So it depends on the... So in some countries it's lack of credit, lack of finance. In South Africa, some of the work that seems like it's a combination of a huge number of factors. So it's transport costs between where people live and places where they can sell. It's crime, because carrying the stuff around with you from where you live to where you're trading is very dangerous. It's a lack of protection in terms of their ability to trade where they are traded. So they might be in the US, right, for sure, or that. So there's a whole array of factors. And some of them are quite bizarre. So one of the things in some of the people finds that jealousy within the community stops people from making
jealousy.
So if you're successful, people are worried that they're going to be jealous. And whatever that means. So it's important to realize that not all these people are economic. And there might be some people might be borrowers and crazy reason, but in terms of if it's important enough reason for the individual, they won't. So it's one of these things that we have to try and work how do we change that situation where people don't get that chance. I'm going to carry on because I want to finish before time and then we can talk. Skills, I haven't really mentioned, but skills are a huge problem in South Africa, and it's sort of a contradiction. We have this huge labor surplus, but we're also employment, but at the same time we lack skills. And this is a symptom of structural change, it's a symptom of technological change, and it's something that's been from the media education system. And it's an effect of the education system pre-94, and I think one of my viewers on the board as well is the effect of the education. Despite the size of the education, there's still huge issues with the education system. One of the big problems is the introduction of the C system, which is the big system in terms of training. So those are paying 1% payroll to teachers. That is used to find the training. It essentially undermines the old system of training of artisans, which has become a huge problem. And so we see issues in terms of ESCOM and lack of technicians and so labeling. These are important jobs, especially in terms of manufacturing and those kind of industries.
I understand what you're saying. Is
can I finish this and then we can talk? Employers are often reluctant to do their training. And for whatever reason that might be, it is something, so employers are saying it's too expensive, we can't rely on people staying, because I think today people are much more mobile in the labor market than they were maybe 50 years ago. So people maybe can change jobs so often, and firms can recruit their training investment. Now you train someone and another firm approaches them because they've got this awesome training. At the tertiary level, we have a mismatch between supply and demand. And it's basically people are saying anything. I think we saw that now again with registrations. People are essentially choosing, they were saying people were choosing in the queue. Whatever was available, they would take as long as there was a space for them. Because people realize the value of tertiary education. But the problem is if you're studying a BA today, it is far less marketable than if you were studying engineering or if you were studying something, even commerce is sort of stuck in the middle where it's, in some ways it's doing well and in other ways it's doing poorly. But it's really young people just are not equipped to choose fields of study that are going to guarantee them work when they leave. This is one of the last slides. Again, many times in terms of labor market outcomes, this is looking, a lot of people argue the education system is open, people are allowed to access wherever they want, so they can study wherever they want. But the work that we've done looks at unemployment rates of graduates from tertiary institutions, so there's some universities, that were historically white or historically black. So AWI is a historically white institution, HDI is a historically black institution. And it looks at unemployment rates. And what we find is that even if you compare an African graduate from ECT with a white graduate from ECT, the unemployment rate of the white graduate is lower. Okay? And that's controlling for field of study, that's controlling for age, all kinds of things. There's a lot of econometric analysis that goes on. But essentially, there remains this huge difference in labor market outcomes, even where education is. And then the last one is about space. Now, in South Africa, space is very important because we had so many laws controlling location and controlling where people were allowed to locate. Now, this graph, I just thought this map up was quite interesting. It's constructed by the CSIR, and it's really looking at connectedness and economic activity. So how strong is economic activity with population density? And what you see, high population density and high economic activity is the red areas. Yellow areas is high population density and low economic activity. And those are the yellow areas, which you can see is essentially the thermal overlaps. So we have a lot of people living in areas where there is just nothing going on, just being hungry. And so there's no way that they will get a job in that area. And this is one of the big problems, because either we have too many people, or we have too many economy, and both are very
okay, and then this is just in terms of inequality. Looking at wage inequality, if we look by race, and we look at average wages across the age distribution, we can see wages for white people obviously are way higher than wages for African people. And so we still, this is one of the big sources of inequality within our society, and it's one of the things that it is necessitating the social grant system. Social grant system and the tax system to try and create the inequality that exists. But I think the consensus is that without more employment, no matter what you do in terms of tax and grants, is not going to create the inequality that we have today.
And this is my last slide.
Unemployment is the key labour market challenge in South Africa, and the recession has done, as I know, all the huge amount of progress that we've made in the 2000s. There's been a secular trend towards the tertiary sector, so activity and employment is moving to the tertiary sector, and that has meant that it's higher skill populations like the demand. We have low labour force participation rates and a very low employment population ratio. We have massive inequalities in the labour market. And the spatial information that we have raised the cost of labour because people need to take transport to work. And they generate regional imbalances. And we see some provinces like our area is very well in terms of unemployment, and going to quite low. But you go to the programs and unemployment is really common. And that's just about space, how we need to create those imbalances. Sorry, I took a little long. Just an example, apparently, in the local community.
they are kind of more critical for employing carpenters because they're using the old carpenter of the time and the old carpenter of the time. And so that is, I think this is a kind of serious strong. Yeah, it's and I think it's also quite a certain amount of systems change, such a huge change. That kind of is not entirely right, but there is a condition that the payment system is not functioning as it should be. There is big gaps in the policies, there is big gaps in the conservative. So again, this whole change in terms of the training environments where it was making people seem to be suitable. So that if they got stuck in something simple to die, but they wouldn't then say, I've got these skills, and people would say, but we don't want this, we can't do this. And it's about trying to make sure that the employees are people who are flexible. And that's what the board said, we want people to be flexible so that they can really combine them.
I mean, I think that's definitely, it is one of these big problems, but it's happened. I think we have to move on from it's happened, and we have to try and figure out a way to resolve that problem. that I do. I think what we need to recognize is that there isn't a one policy that's going to sort out the problem. My feeling on the issue is really we need to be experimenting as much as we can. We are putting huge amounts of money into things like EPWP, into expanded public works, into the community works program, but I think we need to be far more creative and say, do you think that this might work? Here's R1 million, go and try it and see how it works. Do you think that policy might work? Go and try it. And then if they do work, or if they work partially, then we can start refining. But the problem is we try one or two big things, and they do work to an extent, but I don't think we have nearly the kind of policy innovation that we do need. I think we need to be experimenting and trying to sort things, you know, to say, is a youth wage subsidy going to work? Is having less restrictive hiring and firing legislation going to help? And I think there are moves, like the example I mentioned in terms of the textile industry, where there has been this move between employers and unions to try and see what are the issues. So by lowering the employment costs of young people, that kind of experimentation, I think, is really what we need. Because countries that have been successful have put into place innovative solutions that are sort of tailored to their circumstances. And I think that's, we tend to try and, we look at what other people do, and we don't necessarily learn from the mistakes that they've made. And I think what we need to do is to try and sort of pave our own way and to say, these are the things, these types of things are working, let's just try a whole lot of variations and see where we go. Because I think the urgency of the problem is huge. Other countries have found for every year of unemployment that young people have, their lifetime earnings are reduced. And so if we're sitting with people who are unemployed at age 30 and have never worked before, we are going to be sitting with huge problems in terms of this. Closer to the microphone. And I think sort of SARS has also sort of seen that, and there have been kind of moves to make things a bit more simple for smaller businesses. But I think that's a different issue in terms of that switch from sort of small, more informal to sort of medium-sized formal is very difficult. And in terms of labour legislation, that there are recommendations in terms of trying to get to pull small businesses, for example, out of the extension of the bargaining council and so on. So I think people are slowly starting to recognize that hurdle is actually a huge hurdle, not just a sign on the dotted line like an arm of a business.
Thank you.